Big welcome to the Heritage Council podcast, and a theme that we are embracing for this series in 2021 is inclusive heritage. This will involve a broad overview of the multi-layered experiences which encompass Ireland's past, and will also put into context how this sense of heritage is all about our collective experience, and why so much of what went before still resonates in the present. I hope you enjoy the show. This year marks the 75th anniversary of the Rural Electrification Scheme, one of the greatest social and economic developments in 20th century Ireland. In today's podcast, we speak with Deirdre McParland, Senior Archivist with ESB. She looks back at what life was like in Ireland before electricity, as well as the impact and legacy of rural electrification. We also speak with Aoife Murphy, a chartered engineer who has worked in New Zealand and Ireland. After moving to New Zealand in 2010, the Christchurch earthquake struck, which led Aoife to working for over 6 years repairing homes damaged by the earthquake sequence as part of the Earthquake Commission. In late 2016, with a view to moving home, she applied for a scholarship with the Society for the Protection of Ancient Buildings in the UK. For 9 months, she travelled the UK and Ireland learning all about the various skills involved in the repair of historical buildings. In 2018, Aoife was awarded Engineers Ireland's Chartered Engineer of the Year Award. She was also part of the project team who were awarded for the Heritage and Conservation Award for the Swords Castle East Tower Consolidation Project. I hope you enjoyed the show. Deirdre McParland, how are you keeping?
Very well, thank you.
A big welcome to the Heritage Council podcast. And I believe you're the Senior Archivist with ESB.
I am indeed, Greg. Yeah, I've been working there now in ESB Archives for the past 5 years. But like most of your listeners now here for the past year, I've been working from home. So I've had to leave our beautiful new archive building, which we opened officially last January. So we're really proud of our new archives building. It's based in Finglas in Dublin. And it's all based on low passive sustainable design. So it's a perfect environment for our precious archives, just to ensure that they're preserved in our vaults and that they're accessible for future generations to come.
And why bother? Why don't we just throw out all this old stuff? Who cares, Deirdre?
Well, all that old stuff is really valuable, because what we have in our archives in ESB, it tells the story of the electrification of Ireland. So we have over 90 years of documents, original documents. We also have a substantial film archive, oral archive, photographic archive, and they're all preserved in our electronically controlled vaults. And we have also released our key stories and the stories of the electrification of Ireland on our website. So we launched our digital platform back in 2016. So it's been really successful. We've had just over 1.5 million views to date. And we have an interactive map there where you can look up your town or your village or parish and see when that particular area got electrified, either through the Shannon scheme or rural electrification. So we've got some really fantastic documents that we would preserve the history of ESB. As I said, that's over 90 years old now. So we would have collections ranging from our generation stations, our major projects like the Shannon scheme, rural electrification. We've absolutely some beautiful advertising collections and marketing as well, and a lot of engineering maps as well. So it's quite a diverse collection that we have. And we're open, well, pre-COVID, open by appointment to researchers. So we'd attract quite a diverse global audience of researchers. And obviously, we're able to still facilitate as much as we can online now as well.
And will it be open to the general public in time?
Yep, absolutely. Yep. As I say, we officially opened last January. So a little bit short-lived, just the first few months as it happens. But we're open by appointment to the public. And if anybody has any inquiries, they can just email us at esbarchives.ie.
You're interested in being an archivist. Where does that actually come from? And when you do take a position as an archivist in an organization, what are you trying to do in those roles?
Yeah, well, I guess my interest in archives, it started off, I guess, just, you know, when I was in school. Probably no surprises that I really loved history. So I did my primary degree in history and Celtic studies. And then I was very interested in, first of all, the heritage sector. So I worked in the heritage sector and tourism for the first few years of my career, probably the first nearly 10 years of my career. And then I fell into the archives side of things. So I returned to college to get my qualification in archives and records management. And then I was always really interested in business archives. So that's really where I've specialized since becoming qualified as an archivist. So I worked in the Guinness Archive for 8 years, and then I had the opportunity to gain a new role in ASB Archives, which I was really thrilled about, because it was really an opportunity there to really utilize the archives. And like, my job is to preserve and make sure that we catalog and make accessible the records of ASB. But also what I really love about my job as well is how all that information is utilized. So, you know, we would work closely with researchers. Like, for example, we worked really closely with one of our researchers quite recently in the past year, where she curated an exhibition all around the stories of the women's role in rural electrification. And that was in the National Museum of Ireland, the National Museum of Country Life in Castlebar. And then we would do a lot of these talks and participation seminars as well. So it's a really, really varied role.
You mentioned the role of women in the electrification project. What exactly was that role?
We talk about rural electrification. So ESB rolled out rural electrification that first began on the 5th of November 1946. So really, when the greater part of Europe was coming out of war, we embarked on this whole new innovation. It was like, I guess, the second phase of the Shannon scheme. Because after the war, so throughout the 1930s and the 1940s, although the Shannon scheme had provided electricity to people living in the towns and cities, 2/3 of the population of Ireland, and that was the people living in rural Ireland, they still didn't have access to an electricity supply. So when we embarked in the scheme, we worked really closely with local communities to roll out electricity. And in particular, voluntary organisations like the Irish Country Women's Association and Mintre na Tíre and Machra na Ferma. So women, particularly the ICA, it was just such a great collaboration between the ICA and ESB, because they were really the main influencers and advocates for rural electrification, because they knew it was going to be absolutely a game changer for them. And so they really campaigned tirelessly to their neighbours to sign up to an electricity supply. A really big issue at that time was that there was no access to piped water in rural Ireland. And the word that we see Ireland being described as back then was that life was full of drudgery, particularly for women whose roles traditionally at that time were mainly in the home or working in the farm. They were responsible for the domestic chores and a lot of the farming chores as well. So they really knew that the coming of electricity was going to be absolutely transformative to their lives.
How far after electricity was in the cities did it follow into the country?
Well, first of all, we had the Shannon scheme. So Ard na Cruithe was our very first generation station, and electricity came on stream from Ard na Cruithe and the Shannon scheme in October of 1929. So from that time onwards and throughout the 1930s, ESB were really busy connecting the major towns and cities to an electricity supply. And the plan was always, because the Shannon scheme, it was to provide electricity on a national scale. So the plan was also always going to electrify rural Ireland. As I say, World War II began, so that put the plans on hold. So that meant then from, say, 1929, when the towns and cities had been electrified, it wasn't until 1946 that we could begin embarking on rural electrification. So rural electrification, it took place from the first phase of it from 1946 to 1965. And then the second phase ran right up to 1978. So by that stage, we'll say from 1929, only 40,000 homes had electricity supply. It was actually only 1% of the population. To we find, if you fast forward to 50 years later, 99% of the population then had access to an electricity supply. And it was just really interesting as well how rural electrification, how it was rolled out. So for the purpose of the scheme, ESB divided Ireland into 792 areas. So pretty much based on the same parish boundaries that we have today. And we would electrify one village at a time. And first of all, how the program started was that we had canvassers, and they would go out to the local community and they'd be knocking on people's doors and they'd be asking them, were they going to sign up to an electricity supply? So we would have electrified villages that were deemed to be most economically viable. So pretty much the more people that you had signing up to an electricity supply in your particular village, the quicker your village would then get connected to an electricity supply. And that's why, you know, we work so closely with the voluntary organizations to help influence people as well. Because if you think about it, electricity is something that we very much take for granted today. But back then it was a relatively new commodity. So, you know, people were fearful and skeptical. So we really had to educate people on the benefits that electricity was going to bring and how it was going to transform their lives. So as I say, it began in 1946 in Kilsallaghan. That's when the first pole was raised in North County Dublin. And throughout the scheme, we raised over 1 million poles throughout the length and breadth of the country. And throughout the scheme as well, what was really interesting, it was that whole sense of community. And so we'd ESB crews working all around the country, electrifying the various different communities. And what was lovely about the scheme was that once a village was connected, or an area was connected to an electricity supply, there was what was called a switch-on ceremony. And that's where the whole village would gather in, usually in the parish halls or the community halls. And it was usually the parish priest at the time that would switch on the electric. And it would have been a huge celebration for the community and for the ESB staff who were working in the communities as well. And they would have had great celebrations and turning on the light. So we have all those stories on our website. As I say, it's like 1,300 records. So you can look and see when each area was electrified.
That must have been quite amazing, because I can imagine at the beginning of the rollout, as you were saying, certain communities would have been a bit skeptical. But when they realize that a town gets plugged in and they've all the excitement and the benefits, I'm sure some of the skeptical ones then want to be next in the queue.
Oh, well, that's it. Absolutely. So it really was that sense of, I guess, a little bit of keeping up with the Joneses as well, you know, that, you know, you wanted to have all the mod cons, shall we say, and all the new electrical appliances in your home as well. But through our records as well, we have some really great stories, you know, with the various different switch-ons. But one that stood out to me was in Drumlish. They really celebrated well there. It was probably one of the switch-on ceremonies that if I could wind back, if I could step back into history, I would have liked to have been at that one, because they actually celebrated with champagne and salmon, two possibly of my favourite things to indulge on occasion. So you've really beautiful social stories like that, and, you know, the coming together of various different communities. And we also had demonstrators in ESB. So we had our male demonstrators, but again, we also had women demonstrators in ESB. And their role was to travel around the length and breadth of the country and literally to do demonstrations in people's homes, and to educate them on the various different appliances that they could use. So we had our people going into people's homes and baking bread in the ovens for them. And also demonstrations would have taken place in the parish halls as well. And even some on the roadsides. We have some amazing photographs that show, you know, demonstrations taking place in the roadsides. So bringing out all the various new electrical appliances. Actually, we opened some pop-up shops as well. Pop-up shops are very in vogue now, but we were doing that back in the 1950s. And Blackwater, actually in County Wexford, was one of our most successful pop-up shops. So we've got some beautiful photos there as well, selling all the electrical appliances. But it's funny as well, when you look at the selling of the appliances, we see, I'm thinking, one of the reports that we have actually from 1953 and 1954, and it was showing that the best sellers of the appliances was the iron. So no wrinkly shirts going around there in rural Ireland. And then kettles were next, and then the radio, and then the washing machines. So our customers, they would have bought the smaller appliances first, and then, you know, as you get more money, you build up to the larger appliances as well.
And getting electricity in your home, was that a very democratic process, or did it involve big upfront checks to get the installation done in your house?
We would have recommended, and we see this through all our PR pamphlets, that we would have educated the public on, you know, getting the electricity into the house. So while we connected to the areas, then it was up to the individuals to connect the actual houses. But from an absolute safety point of view, we did advise that it was ESB electricians that would come in and make the connection. So we've got some great stories there as well. And one of our ads as well, it was all about our electrician. And our ad had said, you know, we will bring our really highly skilled and expert electricians into your home. And they were very much welcomed into the homes as well by the general public. And one of our ads as well, it says that our aim is to give you an electrical installation and to do it as quickly, quietly and efficiently as we possibly can. So really kind of instilling confidence in our employees there as well. And what was interesting as well was all the language that we have used in our advertising as well. Like, we used very simple language. Like, one of our ads, this kind of going back now to the 1930s, the strap line was that a child can do it. So that literally at the flick, you just turn on, flick of a switch, you know, that a child can do it.
Was there any big pockets of resistance in the country? We don't want it. Forget about it. And they held out as long as they could. Are there any culprits there, Deirdre?
Well, now, Greg, I'm not going to start naming and shaming any particular areas, but we do have great records. Like, we have internal publications from our rural electrification office. So if there was an area where people weren't really that willing to sign up to an electricity supply, then we would like really do kind of a full scale kind of marketing campaign in that area. And we would go down and do demonstrations there. And it was really the power of persuasion to be used. But really, I guess on a serious note, was really to show how transformative electricity was going to be to people's lives and to understand some possible doubts that people would have. There obviously would have been financial concerns for people as well. So that's where we produce some films. Like, we have like a beautiful film called More Power to the Farmer. And it was really explaining how price of electricity, you know, works, what a unit can do for you as well, and making it. And it's always been ESB's purpose from the very start as well, was, you know, to provide electricity. With a quote from our managing director at the time, to provide electricity cheaply and abundantly. So we really didn't want to be putting pressure on our customers, but it was to really understand their needs. But sometimes we did have problems where, you know, you would go into an area and canvas the area and looking good, you know, that they were going to sign up to electricity. So you'd have a good few hundred people signing up to electricity. But then we did have the problem of what was called backsliders. And these were people who agreed to sign up to an electricity supply, but then when it came to getting it, that they changed their mind as well. And that would have caused some problems. That would have delayed that particular area then getting connected to an electricity supply.
And the Shannon scheme was the thing that enabled all of this. So from when that project started to when ESB was being produced from it, how long did that take?
Well, the Shannon scheme began in August of 1925. That's when the construction began at Ardna Crusha in County Clare. And it took 4 years to complete. So it was officially opened in July of 1929 by the president of the Executives Council, William Cosgrave. And then the electricity actually came on supply in a few months later in October of 1929. And after that time, then we were connecting the major towns and cities, first of all. And we also had to build a whole new distribution network as well, you know, across Ireland, because before Ardna Crusha and also before ESB was established, there was no national grid. So electricity supply was really dispersed throughout the country, and it was mainly provided by the local authorities. So, you know, you would have had your industries in the major cities at that time, you know, and obviously they had access to electricity supply. And there would have been about 180 independent suppliers of electricity. But as I say, it was really dispersed. But a supplier of electricity was deemed to be any supplier who was actually supplying 3 customers or more. So you could have, you know, like a really small amount of customers and they would be deemed an electricity supplier. But the whole concept for the Shannon scheme, and it was really a young engineer, Thomas McLaughlin, who really pushed forward his idea to harness the River Shannon. He was employed by Siemens Stuttgart in Berlin, and it was really his influencing. He convinced the Irish Free State government to invest in the scheme, and it was a massive investment at the time, you know. And Thomas McLaughlin himself, he was a young guy, he was only in his late 20s. So, and together with Siemens, you know, they drew up the plans to harness the River Shannon. And the government, they obviously liked the plans when they were first presented to them, but they weren't, I guess, 100% convinced. So they had hired an international team of 4 experts to review the plans. And once the experts came in and reviewed the plans, that's when we then produced a white paper. The government produced the white paper to allow for construction to begin. But it was a massive project. It was the largest engineering project of its kind in Europe at that time. And it cost £5.2 million, which, to put that into context, it was 20% of the national budget. And it's all against the context as well. So this was in the 1920s, so it was 1925 when it began. But it was all that whole sense of nation building as well, because, you know, Ireland was after coming out of, you know, a really bitter civil war, and then the War of Independence followed. Sorry, the other way around. And it was that sense that the country, it really had to be rebuilt from within. And it was that whole sense of making Ireland modern as well, and even paving the way for further commercial and industrial activity as well. And one of our ads actually at the time, to me, it kind of summed up the whole ethos of the Shannon scheme as well. And it stated that the Shannon is being harnessed to lighten human burdens and to brighten human lives. And I just think that was such a beautiful sentence. And it was really showing how transformative that the coming of electricity was going to be to Irish society and creating that brighter future for Irish people.
It was literally switching a whole country on, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And clever marketing people. I'm liking all of their jargon around their campaigns. They're very powerful.
And again, that was down to Thomas McLaughlin. Actually, he headhunted a Dublin journalist, Ned Lawler. And Ned Lawler then formed ESB's public relations department. And that was in 1928, so just a year after ESB was established. And just the foresight that they had, I think it was so powerful. Like Thomas McLaughlin and Siemens, obviously, they were really aware of the amount of electricity that the Shannon was going to generate. But it was all fine and well generating electricity, but we needed to ensure that people were going to buy into the concept as well and to sign up to it. So that's where Thomas McLaughlin, he visited the United States, and a great learning that he took away from that was that he had to educate the masses on the benefits of electricity. So that's how he created, along with Ned Lawler, the public relations department. And obviously, this was really long before social media. So the only way to really educate and to infiltrate the messages about electricity and the coming of the Shannon scheme was through the national newspapers. So we launched an extensive advertising campaign in the national newspapers. And we also opened up a tourist office down in Limerick, down in Ardna Croitia as well. And we put on special transport and over 85,000 people, and this is still while the construction was going on when you think about it, 85,000 people visited Ardna Croitia while the construction was ongoing in 9 months. So I think it shows how successful it was. But we as a company back then, we really wanted to share the story and educate people. And the copy that we used as well in that particular ad was to see this mighty project in the making. So we really wanted to instill a sense of national pride in everybody about the Shannon scheme. And it was the whole idea of that whole power of thinking big, literally. You know, we were a really small island, but look what we are going to achieve by building our very first national grid.
And tell me, was the country aligned politically at the time?
Well, before it was approved, there were a lot of debates going on in the Dáil. So not everybody would have been aligned. And there were some elements that were referring to it as a white elephant, you know, and laughing a little bit, I guess, at the scheme, you know, that, you know, what are we going to do? You know, we're generating all this electricity, but sure, we don't need it. And, you know, there was lots of debate in the early 1920s around, you know, should we look at the River Shannon or would we be better off looking at the River Liffey, kind of starting smaller scale, first of all. But, you know, Thomas McLaughlin, he was really determined and I guess like really courageous as well, along with the Minister for Industry and Commerce at that time, actually, Patrick McGilligan. They firmly believed that the Shannon scheme, that it had to be for its success, it had to be a national solution. So if we had harnessed the River Liffey, first of all, that would have only been really for Dublin. And that was not the ambition at all of Thomas McLaughlin or indeed Patrick McGilligan.
I'm guessing if we need any reference point at all, Deirdre, to what that was like, we can think about broadband now. It's nearly the equivalent to ESB. Thank you so much for your time. Now, I have one last thing to ask of you.
Yeah.
Are you up for getting together at Drumlit? I'll bring the champagne if you bring the salmon.
Yes. Absolutely. As soon as this 5K, as soon as we can leave, our 5K or indeed travel out of our county again. Yeah, top of the list.
We can recreate the ceremony, Deirdre, you and me. How about it?
Absolutely. But for now, look, we'll recreate it online.
Exactly. Where is Drumlit, by the way?
Drumlit, County Longford.
County Longford.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll have to check out my map.
Yeah.
Deirdre, thank you so much for coming on the Heritage Council podcast and giving me your time.
Thank you very much for having me, Greg.
Take care. Thank you.
Thank you.
In the second segment of this episode, I chat with Aoife Murphy, a chartered engineer who worked in New Zealand as part of the Earthquake Commission, and who is now working in Ireland on various historic building projects. Aoife Murphy, how are you keeping? A big welcome to the Heritage Council podcast.
Hi, how are you? Nice to be involved.
And I believe you're a chartered engineer with David Kelly Partnership in lovely Yule.
Yes, enjoying the sunshine today after all that rain last week, but yeah.
You're obviously in your house and you're telling me you're looking out over the sea, which is, I'm jealous. I can see the sun on your face, which is really, really nice. So that interest in engineering in the first place, where did that come from?
It was interesting because I didn't have engineering on my horizon. I didn't know what it was, I think, until sixth year in school and near the end of sixth year. I was always good at maths. It was always a strong point. But my focus, my limits are, I think I was doing accounting and business. I had no interest in this. Sciences, or I wasn't pushed that direction anyway. And then I went to like an open day, I think in Waterford IT, and a few things like that. And now someone mentioned it. Now they were talking about working in a lab or working on a site or in a design office. And I was like, that kind of sounds like interesting rather than the whole desk job straight. And the fact that I was good at maths, they said it was a huge advantage. And it just sounded interesting to me. So on the change of mind form, I think it was July after my leaving cert, I changed everything to engineering, not really knowing what the hell engineering was. But that was where I fell in with it, I guess. I opened the phone book then after that and looked up every engineering company within the Carlow-Kilkenny area. And thankfully, one of them in Kilkenny, Hayes Higgins, was kind enough to let me come in as a student and just play around, really, and show me what CAD was and show me what an engineer involved in that office. So that's how I stumbled into it.
And typically the way the genders end up falling, I'm guessing you were one of few who had taken the engineering choice?
Yeah, I ended up going to Trinity. So in Trinity, we probably had a higher proportion of females than most, but it was 20% for first year. That general engineering class in first year was 20%. And I kind of probably more in the civil structural then when I specialised in third year. But that was a sign of the times, I guess. It was 2004, 5, 6, when good times, and it was a good time to go towards construction.
Yeah, of course, Ireland was booming at that time. We were in the middle of Celtic Tiger and everything else.
Well, yeah, we finished in 2007 and we were promised the world. We were like, you're great, you're going to... We all walked into a job, every one of us, no problem at all. And then everything changed quite rapidly.
So when you filled out the change your mind form, did some people think you had lost your mind?
I think my mother primarily. yeah, for sure. But I was thinking about it and I didn't know much at the time, but I was like, a lot of CEOs, a lot of important people start off as a primary degree in engineering. So I was like, it's a good base degree from wherever or whatever direction you want to go. I think it's a good, safe option.
When did you figure out that, yeah, I've made the right choice, this is the right path for me?
It's funny because I've kind of changed my mind over the years as well. I mean, we started working in 2007 for a consultancy in Dublin on big pharma projects and big technology ones, buildings. And everything, of course, fell through and everything went on hold. And after 3 years, I was made redundant. And I just felt like my experience wasn't quite what I'd hoped it would be. I was quite nervous and I wasn't sure in myself. But I mean, it was just a sign of the times. Every job was going on hold and that was just the way things fell. But then I moved to New Zealand then, late 2010. It was just before the big earthquake. It was they had an earthquake 6 months beforehand. So the country was on the verge of recession and suddenly there was all this work in the city. So Christchurch was suddenly full of immigrants and even immigrants within Australia coming to the city to work. And I was managing a team of supervisors, managing contractors repairing earthquake damage. And we just got on the ground a couple of months before the big earthquake, which was just 10 years ago last week. And it was kind of a sink or swim. I was suddenly managing contractors, managing homeowners' expectations, managing repairs and all that kind of stuff. And I loved it. I suddenly went from realizing that sitting down doing design at my desk all day, every day, to out on the site every day, chatting to people and interacting. And I absolutely adored it. So that's where I kind of flourished, I think, more than sitting at a desk.
That's when you discovered the real Aoife.
Yeah, that's it. No, I was definitely kind of, yeah, as I said, a sink or swim, but I was so lucky. I had my boss over there, first guy arrived on the day, his name was Eugene and he was from Tipperary and he'd been there for 25 years and he just looked after me. And each of the bosses I had for the first few years there was kind of in the same boat. They were all just really, I knew I had support if I needed help and that just made a big difference and off we went. It was great.
And that rebuilding, Aoife, just to create a picture for the listeners, was that the odd house that had crumbled or was it literally big, vast areas of buildings that had just disappeared?
Yeah, so New Zealand had this very strange setup, which is very clever. They set up the Earthquake Commission, I think in the 70s, I'm not sure the exact, but everybody paid a premium on top of their house insurance. And this fund was managed by the Earthquake Commission. And any natural disasters, the first $100,000 was paid out of this fund. So my company was hired by the Earthquake Commission to manage the repairs of buildings with less than 100,000 worth of damage. That was 70,000 houses. So I was involved in probably 5,000 of those over 6.5 years.
Wow.
It was just huge scale, massive. Anything from painting, decorating, like they really picked off the easy ones first. And then some of them were quite structural, but obviously the rebuilds would have gone over the cap, over the 100,000 mark. So a lot of those would have gone over, but some did, big ones stayed with us. So it was kind of massive.
So you were literally rehousing people again, were you?
We were getting them back into their homes, yeah. The whole, they red zoned quite a lot of the city. The Avon River flows through Christchurch and anything within a couple of metres of the river sank into the river, subsidence. The city's built on a swamp and probably shouldn't have been settled on in the first place. Like the Maori are all across the river in Rangiora. The English and the settlers, they came and they built in Christchurch, but it's quite a swampy city. So the earthquake itself, like, did definitely cause damage, but it was the liquefaction and the subsidence in the hours afterwards. And there was sand everywhere and water coming up out of the ground and all kinds of stuff. That was the big, a lot of damage to most of the houses I dealt with anyway.
Do you go back there now at any time?
I'd love to go back. I'm dying to go back. Yeah. So, yeah. The next, hopefully, next 2 or 3 years, we'll go back for a visit. I mean, your friends over there became your family because you were together and the people we worked with were all very close. It was great.
Yeah. It must have been fairly inspiring watching a whole place being rebuilt.
Yeah. No, it was amazing. I mean, every week there was something new opening up. And I'm sure since I left, there was a lot. They were still demolishing the week I left in 2017. So that was 6 years later. They were still demolishing a car park right in Cathedral Square, and Cathedral Square is only getting under, the cathedral itself is only being rebuilt now. The tower of it toppled over, so it did look quick.
And was it an urge to travel again or an interest in historic buildings that led to your next move?
It was kind of a mixture. So I was kind of going, after 5 years in New Zealand, I was very much, am I staying or am I going home? And there's no earthquake in Ireland, so how am I going to adapt this to Ireland? And before I left for New Zealand, I'd applied for a scholarship with the SPAB, the Society for the Protection of Ancient Buildings in the UK. And I decided to reapply. It's a scholarship program where about three or four professionals, engineers, architects, or surveyors are chosen each year to travel around the UK and Ireland as well, and stay with people, like stay with a thatcher and learn how to thatch, go to a forge, visit the architects, surveyors, visit all these people and stay with them and learn their skills and learn from them and meet them and get that personal one-on-one time with them. Sleep on the floor, they feed you. It's amazing. So I spent, that was my journey then. So I got offered that, and that was my stepping stone home then. I did that for 9 months and met amazing people along the way. That kind of opened the doors, and I realized the subsidence and all that stuff that I learned about settlements and things in New Zealand is very much adaptable to old buildings. That so it worked. I felt like I found my little niche in Ireland that worked and what I learned over there.
And did you have an interest in old buildings before that, did you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. My thesis in college was on Burris House. That's where I'm from, Burris and Carlow. I mean, I grew up, my family graveyard is St Mullins, and we grew up playing on the round tower and the moat and all that kind of stuff there. So I mean, I was always around. Both grandparents lived on farms, with lots of old farm buildings around. So it was always an interest anyway, always something I enjoyed.
Yeah. So that led to eventually you getting back to Ireland and taking up a role here.
That was it. Yeah. So the final part of the scholarship involved a week at a time in country houses and castles. And I separated from the other two for a while to come to Ireland because I kind of wanted to see a bit. One of my visits was I stayed in Lismore Castle for a week. And John Kelly came up to visit me, and I was up there and we had a chat and he offered me an interview. So that was one of my stepping stones home then afterwards. I slotted in there.
You've worked on some unusual projects with the David Kelly Partnership, haven't you?
Yeah, so I've been very lucky. I mean, 95% of the projects I've worked on have been older buildings, whether that could be a lot of ruins or some interesting ones like Swords Castle. That was a really... I learned an awful lot on that one. Swords Castle, it was the east tower of Swords Castle, was probably the main part of the project. It was a tower that had only three walls remaining, but the center wall was bowing out big time at the top. There was big steel supports supporting it. When we were involved, Lisa Edden and Trina Byrne had been involved in the earlier phase. They had a provisional design. We worked with that, so I was able to come in and have a look at their designs and do detailed design to go with it and work with the contractors on site. And it was such an interesting one. We tied the three walls together with a concrete slab, which probably doesn't sound like the ideal thing for conservation, but
yeah.
It was needed because that center wall was bowing out. So we managed to remove down the masonry just to try and remove the worst of that big bow in it. And it did look like it might collapse. It looked quite in danger. So we reinforced the corners. We put this slab in to try and tie it together. And then we actually put a hole in the center of the slab to try and draw all the water away from the building. Everything was about drawing water because the building was green. It was so wet. Everything about it was soaked. We designed like lime mixes to try and get the right mortar mix. There was quite a lot of concrete on it, or cement. And then a shelter coat as well around the outside to try, again, everything was all about using the existing old materials and try and draw out the water. So I think it's going to be slightly green for a while it's going to take years for it to dry up properly, but it's now in the center of the Swords Village, which is nice. So it's right across from the Fingal offices. So there, I hope it's looking well. They're looking at it every day there.
What are the challenges when you're working with an old building like that? Where do you even begin?
The biggest thing is adaptability. I mean, you can't go in with this is how we're going to fix it and that is it attitude. There's a lot of research probably at the start to try and figure out what has happened here, what's going wrong, and then have a look at the history of it and has it had different reiterations, what's been its use over the years and what's newer, what's older, and then a bit of research if you can, some like figure out what the foundations are, some digging might be required, and find out what services are in the area. Then you can start thinking about then the building itself. Once you need a good contractor. I mean, I can design the best repair strategy in the world, but if you don't have good stonemasons and carpenters and people on the ground doing the work, it's not going to be done right. So you have to really work together to try and adapt your solution as you go. I mean, you have a general idea of how it's going to be repaired, but things do change when you remove bits and pieces here and there, and suddenly you get, yeah, there's always surprises, but you're always learning things as well. You're always learning about different materials used. It's always interesting. I find it really good.
Yeah, and some of the other projects I noticed that you worked on was the Drumcullen church ruins and the old town wall.
Yeah, so Drumcullen is one in Offaly. Actually, we just did another phase of it with the community monument scheme just done there in October. So it's a lovely little ruins in the, it's near Kinnity in Offaly. So we've done quite a good bit of work with Offaly and Laois County Council, actually. They tend to give us quite a lot of little church ruins that are so lovely to work on because they're all in the middle of nowhere and they're probably somebody local who's interested and they'll help out and they tend to supply water and electricity if they can for the builder. And they have, those jobs are always lovely because the contractors involved tend to love their jobs. They tend to enjoy the history and the people around do too. So you've always, they're just nice projects to work on, nice people, and get a really nice result on them as well. We've had loads of little jobs up there and they're very good.
And the old town wall, and I just noticed doing my little bit of research, that's part of the Irish Wall Towns Network. And that's a Heritage Council, I think, grant or initiative.
Absolutely, yeah. So we get a lot of the work I do work on is grant work. I think it's just been announced this week, so I'm waiting to hear what the news is. This year's scheme is just being announced. But yeah, we've done Kilkenny Town Walls as well, and you all feathered. We've done a few different ones around. Oh, and Tipperary, we're doing Carrick and Cashel last year as well. So they're all lovely to work on as well. As I said, directly with the councils, apply for the grants through the Heritage Council. The GLOS scheme is another one we work on with the Heritage Council. It's a very nice one for farm buildings. If farmers are in the GLOS scheme, they tend to be more on the environmental side anyway, so they're more open to using the traditional materials such as lime and trying to reinstate the buildings as we can, yeah.
And what does it do to Joe Public when you see an old ruin come back to life again? What does it do to people?
People love it. People just have a fascination with it. And they, like, I often get people saying they're envious of my job. It's just people do... They remember stories from growing up, from their parents, from their grandparents. It just brings out something in people that they really find it interesting. And they just want to, everyone has a story about a building as well. So when you're on site, you just, it's lovely to listen and hear what people have to say about it and explore it. I mean, looking around these old churches, the graveyards are amazing. You can see the stonemasons. You can see the style of the whoever was doing all the letter carving and all the different detail in it. And they're enjoyable. This makes it a nice job. So it is when you enjoy going to your site every day. It doesn't have the big pressures, I think, of some of the big jobs in construction can.
Yeah, because it's very interesting. On last week's episode, we spoke to two Michael Kennys, believe it or not, about coins and coinage and the way history can be told through all of the different coins that you find. And if a small little object like that can tell a big story, obviously these big, beautiful buildings, or maybe not so big, just a wall around a town, is another big way to tell a story of a place and remind us of our heritage and where we've come from.
Yeah, I think here in Yall is a big pride in the old buildings. There's a medieval festival here. I think the Irish Tibetan Walls Network sponsored that as well. And it's lovely to see all the costumes in the market and things like that. But it's a central part of a visit to the town. Yeah, and the St. Mary's Church as well. It's just incredible. It's a really nice place here to walk around. It's these old towns, they should be lived in more. Like there's so much life here and it's so nice. You had to be surrounded by this history.
I know in 2018, your work was recognised by the Chartered Engineers because you won the Chartered Engineer of the Year Award. That was for your work in New Zealand, wasn't it?
That was such a surprise. It was wonderful. Most engineers working after at least 4 years, I was nearly 8 or 9 years, I think, by the time I applied. You apply for the next step, and that's chartership. So you have to show competencies and show that you meet the criteria of the body, which would be Engineers Ireland in this case. So you fill out the application, and I did it. Actually, I did it in Lismore Castle that week because I had no internet, I had no phone coverage, I had nothing. So I was on my own for a full week. So once it got dark at 6 o'clock, I was ploughing through the report and got it all sorted. And you had to write some essays and things like that as well. So it's not as daunting, I think, as people fear. I think people fear the process, the chartership process. It's not. You do need time, absolutely, to sit down and concentrate. But, I mean, you need that for writing a report or doing anything anyway with work. So it does need probably a week or two of lock yourself in and just get through it. But, write 2 essays and fill it in. And then you have to get 2 of your colleagues who are chartered to confirm what you have written, and then that's submitted. And about 400 engineers a year, I think, are chartered with Engineers Ireland, which is great. But I got a letter that was in June, I think. I got word I chartered, and then in September I got a lovely letter to say I've been put forward to the top 20. I've been shortlisted for Chartered Engineer of the Year. And then I got shortlisted again to the top 6, and suddenly I had to do an interview and do some essays and do things like that. And yeah, it was amazing. I was over the moon to win, yeah, Chartered Engineer of the Year just the year after I got back to Ireland. So it was pretty special for me.
And the name of your paper was Silver Lining, an opportunity in the time of disaster. So what was the silver lining?
It was about basically the earthquake, basically all the opportunity that we got there. That, I mean, there was hundreds and hundreds of Irish arriving in Christchurch, and hundreds of from all over New Zealand and from traveling. When the world was in recession, that we were able to go in and help and learn and contribute to a wonderful society, to really nice people who are really grateful for our help in many ways.
And you received an award as well, I noticed, for the Swords Castle work.
Yeah, so that was the next year we're back at the Engineers Ireland Awards again. So, yeah, we got shortlisted. It's for, yeah, and we won the Conservation Award for Swords Castle, up against really massive projects. Ours is a relatively small one, but I think the techniques and the ideas that we'd used caught the judges' attention, because it was practical, but everything was all about rescuing and saving as much of the original fabric as we could. So yeah, they obviously thought it was worthy, so that was great.
Going back to that gender topic, does a female working as an engineer, does that bring something different to the role than the males do, or would you say it's all the same?
Probably some slight differences. I mean, I definitely struggled and now and then in New Zealand. The builders definitely didn't appreciate talking to a young female sometimes. I mean, you learned definitely quickly to stand up for yourself over there, and that helps me enormously. Once I was confident, I was fine. I think it's when I lack confidence, I probably do struggle a bit. It's probably, I'm not good at blagging. So if I don't know if I'm not sure of something, I'm first to say, I don't know, I'll come back to you and check it out. That was a big learning one. But what I figured in New Zealand as well is I really thrived when I felt like I was doing something good and useful. So maybe that's not a part of engineering that people tend to consider as a normal part of engineering. Because of the project was wrapping up, there was an awful lot of surveys and an awful lot of helping and career development, figuring out where we go next. And that was one of mine. It was, yeah, caring and helping. And how does that fit in with engineering? So I think I've brought that back with me as well. So
the very last question I want to ask you, and I'll let you go then. So I really appreciate your time. Ireland and where we are, and obviously it's so rewarding to bring life back to some old buildings. Is it a blank canvas? Are we running out of old buildings to restore, or is there an abundance? And part two of that question is, if you could pick a project to work on, which would it be?
Yeah, the first one, I think you can't throw a stone in Ireland without hitting an old building. I think they're everywhere. But walk down any main street in any town and anything above the shop front is empty. That kind of answers your second one. I would love to bring main streets in small towns back into use. When I moved to Yall here first, I lived in an apartment above a shop on the main street, and I thought it was an amazing way to move into a new community. I mean, everything was across the road, everything was accessible, and we seem to have lost I don't know why people don't see the value in it. And I think retrofit is going to come into a lot of it. I think there definitely needs to be a lot more help towards people looking to retrofit these old buildings. There's thousands and thousands of empty units across the country, which I think will be a wonderful place for people to live. We just need to change our attitude a bit and get stuck in.
Yeah, so John Spillane, the singer, has a lovely song about Ballincollig Castle. And where I live, if I look over the fields, you can see it's in the middle of a farmer's field somewhere. But that's definitely a project that we need to give someone a little nudge somewhere along the way.
I'm telling you, yeah. Your local councillor, I'd say, if it's council remit.
We should give them a little prod. And I know of a good crew in Yall who might work on that.
Definitely.
Aoife Murphy, thanks a million for coming on the Heritage Council podcast. Thanks for your time.
That's lovely. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're so welcome. Thank you for listening to the Heritage Council podcast. For more information about our projects and programs, our work with others and our publications, please check our website, heritagecouncil.ie. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn, or subscribe to our YouTube channel. See you again soon.